LA leaders call it the greatest thing ever to happen to LAX. Angelinos everywhere say, finally, LAX presents LAMP, a modernization project designed to relieve traffic congestion, connect LAX with public transit, and move you in and out of the airport on a people mover. Coming soonish to your airport, LAX. Get all the details at laxishappening.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hour, and I'm your host, Bo Grunion. Tonight we present a discussion on the persistent legend and rumor of secret underground cities ruled by occult masters in Central Asia, Tibet, and Mongolia. Now we'll approach this subject from three directions. First, the actual Asian source material on Shambhala, Ulamarang, and the cave temples of India. Second, the theosophic ruse of hiding their Hindu and Sikh masters in Tibet, which resulted in a widespread Western misconception of Tibetan Buddhism. Third, we will look at the confabulated writings of Lobsang Rampa, Cyril Hodgkins, and the German traveler's tale, Darkness Over Tibet, by T. Elyon, which may have influenced Heinrich Himmler to send Nazi expeditions to Tibet in search of the masters. Now, we'll consider the more factual and authentic work of Ferdinand Ossendowski, that's Beasts, Men, and Gods, 1922, and the Mongolian version of Shambhala, which he confused with a French author's astral journey to Agartha, which is supposedly located in India or Afghanistan. Finally, we will consider the ancient evidence that has recently come to light indicating that some of this speculative and misrepresented material may have had some basis in fact. And then behind every myth, there is an element of truth. So tune in and we will set forth like Indiana Jones in search of the remote and the mysterious. Now, this is a subject we have dealt with before in different perspectives and at different times in the past, but this time we're going to concentrate on the idea of the secret underground cities in Central Asia themselves and what's behind all of this, and the source material and how it came about and whatever. So, the actual source material, this is our first point of consideration, is the very, very well-established and widespread legend of Shambhala, the secret Buddhist kingdom that the Buddhists in Tibet and in Mongolia both firmly believe, many of them do, that this actually exists, or at least it did exist somewhere in usually to the north of wherever they are. I mean, in Tibet, they say it's up in the Kunlun, and Mongolia, they put it up somewhere in the Altai. And then Shambhala is always a place that's over the next two mountain ranges, and only if you are ready and you are sufficiently spiritually advanced could you possibly find it. Now, I'm going to recount that legend just a little bit and give you some perspective on it. The best book, by the way, on the Shambhala legend, for those of you who like to really get to the authentic meat of the whole thing, is a book called The Way to Shambhala by Edwin Birnbaum. And this is one of these, he's one of these ardent Tibetan students, American, of course, but he went over there and learned the language and spent a great deal of time researching this. And this book is published by Doubleday. It's very, very good. And it gives you a real background on the Shambhala legend. Shambhala was supposed to be, according to the Tibetans, supposed to be in northwestern or northeastern, either one, up around the Tarim Basin. It was supposed to be kind of moving toward Afghanistan. We should mention that there really were, and this is part of our the reality check on all of this, there really were very ancient Buddhist kingdoms up in that area. They even preceded Buddhism in Tibet. You know, Buddhism only arrived in Tibet around about 800 A.D. Before that time, the Tibetans were either Bunpo, which was not just shamanism. Bunpo was a more advanced religion than that. Shamanism has its very ancient roots, of course. I'm not trying to say it isn't advanced. It's just that Bunpo was more of a structured, scriptural, established religion that had very strong shamanic aspects to it. And that preceded Buddhism in Tibet. The Buddhists didn't arrive in Tibet until about 800 AD, about the time Charlemagne, the Empire of Charlemagne, got going into France. And the way that happened, of course, is that the Buddhists were driven out of India when the Muslims came in. The Muslims barely tolerated the Hindus, but they felt that the Buddhists were atheists, and so they proceeded to exterminate them and destroy their temples and their universities and everything, and drive them out of India. What happened at that point was that the Buddhists, the Indian Buddhists went north. Well, some of them, of course, went directly east and into Burma and India and Java and whatever, and into China. But some of them went north, especially Padmasambhava, who was supposed to be the founder of Buddhism in Tibet. He went north with all of the ancient Buddhist tantras that he could salvage and stuffed in his saddlebags and kept on riding, and he was going to keep on riding until there weren't any more Muslims around. So he kept riding north, and he was one of the founders of Buddhism in Tibet. Well, actually, this Shambhala legend got started down in India. And some people think that Shambhala was actually an Indian back before the time of Christ. Shambhala was actually an Indian city which was Buddhist. However, the general opinion is that it was one of these Buddhist kingdoms up around the Afghanistan, Tarim Basin, Western Xinjiang area up in there, which were really earlier than Buddhism in Tibet. And now, if you recall, I just put this in perspective. A few years back, the Taliban, who we've been fighting back and forth in Afghanistan for gosh knows 10 years now, the Taliban blew up these huge Buddhist statues in Afghanistan in a place called Banyan, and they dynamited them because the Wahhabi Muslims are so anti-culture and anti any kind of religious expression. They even bulldozed Mohammed's house. They'll put proscribe people and punish them for celebrating Mohammed's birthday. I mean, these people are awful and anti-cultural, anti-intellectual, anti-progress. They're like, you know, if they had an Alexandrian library to burn, they would go and burn it immediately. You know, they would consider it like taking down our towers, like taking down our twin towers. They would burn the Library of Alexandria just because somehow or other it insults their version of the Quran. And that Banyan, those huge statues, those huge Buddha statues, are from back in that period, actually before Buddhism came to Tibet. So there really were very, very advanced Buddhist kingdoms up in that area, and that was so. This has something to do with the Shambhala legend. Now, some people think that Shambhala was created later, and in a sort of an anti-Islamic legend, because one of the interesting things about the Shambhala legend, and we'll get into this later, it explains a lot of what we're going to be talking about. Shambhala, the Shambhala legend, is not all peace, love, and light. Shambhala is not quite Shangri-La, although Shangri-La, the idea of Shangri-La derives from it. Shambhala has, well, I don't know whether you would call it a dark side, but let's call it a non-peaceful side. And the reason for that is that Shambhala is very, very different from just about any other Buddhist legend. It involves an apocalypse, a coming apocalypse, and there's all these lines of kings, ending with the king of Rudrakakrin, who is going to rise up at a certain point and lead the armies of Shambhala out of the secret kingdom to conquer the world in the name of the Buddhist faith. In other words, they're going to destroy the infidels, they're going to purify the world. And this is very, very, very political. And this is the sort of stuff you use to start holy wars. And we're going to discuss in the course of this discussion, we'll get into a Buddhist holy war that almost got started on this. In fact, they even called it the Shambhala War. And it was kind of engineered by the blind Bogdan Khan and Mad Baron Sternberg and the mysterious manipulator Agvan Dorshif and they were gonna use the Shambhala prophecy as a means of starting a holy war. Now, so it has that aspect to it, and that's important to realize because we're talking about this legend of secret underground cities in Central Asia, where these mysterious brotherhoods engineer these forces and control the world. And this Shambhala legend has some relation to that. And you want to keep that in mind as we go on and explore some of these aspects. Now, The second aspect that we want to discuss about this is what I call the theosophic, that's Blavatsky and her bunch in India, the theosophic ruse of hiding their Hindu and Sikh masters in Tibet. And this resulted in a widespread Western misconception of Tibetan Buddhism. Now, as you recall from our show on Madame Blavatsky, she was in a situation where she was in India after the mutiny, and there was a lot of anti-Christian sentiment in India, and she was Russian, and of course, she was the Russians, the Tsarist Russians, and the British Raj, the British Imperialists, they were having a kind of a Cold War. The Russians really, really did want to invade India and free the Indians from the British, of course. So they had this Cold War going, and Helena Blavatsky was suspected of being a Russian agent, and so her two Mahatmas, Kutumi and Murya, who were actually Ranbir Singh and his brother-in-law. The brother-in-law was a Sikh, and Ranbir Singh, surprisingly enough, was a Hindu with a name Singh, but he was a Hindu. But the two of them were both gurus. They really genuinely were. Ranbir Singh was one of the most brilliant men in Asia, one of the consummate politicians. He really was a master. And so was his brother-in-law. So, but they were bankrolling Blavatsky's theosophy in India. And yet, at the same time, this was anti-Christian, and it was also somewhat anti-British, and she was suspected of being a Russian agent. So Ranbir Singh, who had, of course, tremendous influence on Blavatsky, and financial and spiritual otherwise and everything else, in other words, she was his protege, more or less. He just flat out told her. He said, "Well, you can't say we're in India. You can't because we're going to be arrested and that'd be the end of everything. So you have to move us to Tibet, and you got to do that because otherwise we're out of business." And so she, sure enough, she did that. So consequently, all these teachings were coming down, which they were delivering, and she was promulgating, and calling them Buddhism, the earliest form of Buddhism. What is that, Zandri? What's that early form of Buddhism? Theravada? Yeah, Theravada Buddhism, which was, she called her version of what they call theosophy, she called it Theravada Buddhism, but, it was a mixture of a whole bunch of things, but what they were coming up with, Ranbir Singh and his brother-in-law, what they were writing, was this eclectic mix of some Theravada Buddhism, some Sikh ideas, and some Reform Hindu ideas, and whatever, Vedantic, but it was not, absolutely not, Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, it was a world away from Tibetan Buddhism, but nobody knew that at the time because Tibet was closed. This was before 1904. And when the British finally got to the point where they thought the Russians were smuggling guns and Cossacks and everything into Tibet, partly because of some of the activities of Blavatsky and Nagman Dorjeev and these various intriguers, and they sent an expedition, military expedition, up to Tibet and opened it up, whether it wanted to be opened up or not. And the Dalai Lama had to flee to Mongolia and all of that. But before that, and very shortly after that, Tibet just didn't want any foreigners in the country at all. They just, and the British went along with it. The British established this little presence, little consulate up there, and then they supported the Tibetans and just freezing everybody out. And Tibet was the Forbidden Kingdom, so nobody knew what was going on up there. Nobody did, and because Helena Blavatsky had perpetrated this ruse about saying that all of this stuff that was coming from Ranveer Singh and people got the idea that Tibet was that there were Aryan Caucasian kind of people up there and that their religion was that their philosophy was very much like I say, a mixture of Theravada Buddhism and Sikh thought and Reform Hinduism, and that's what they thought it was, but it wasn't. It was very definitely Tibetan Tantric Buddhism is a mixture of Bunpo shamanism, and with an overlay of Buddhist compassion and philosophy and the idea that everything is illusion, and there is naturally some Hindu influence, of course, but Tibetan Buddhism is not what Blavatsky was, they were indicating. So the West was very confused for a long time. Now, this gave rise to, after Blavatsky, a bunch of channeling. Oh, God, I'm not going to go into, there was Alice Bailey and there was Irene Bassan. There was people channeling Tibetan masters Tibetan masters who had nothing to do. Their teachings they were channeling had nothing to do with Tibetan Buddhism. And so we were getting this erroneous picture. Well, we didn't really find out what was really going on in Tibet. And how what their philosophy really was, and how what their religion was, and whatever, until a woman by the name of Alexandra David Neal, and she has written some very fine books, which are still, the Dalai Lama still recommends them, and she walked all over Tibet and did some very, very good anthropology on Tibet. And she finally, in the 1920s, the combination of her and Evans Wentz, the British scholar, got in close with this Nepalese Tibetan Lama Samdup, and they came out with a series of books on Tibetan Buddhism, which are still very, very good. You know, the Tibetan Book of the Dead and Tibetan Book of Great Liberation, and they're excellent, and they're still good. But the teachings did not start circulating until the late 20s and 30s, and so meanwhile, we have a very distorted view of what's going on in Tibet and also in Mongolia. So, at this point, we need to look at thinking about David Neal and Evans Wentz finally coming out with this material. But right before that material really got disseminated, there was another traveler who claimed that he had been to Tibet and walked all over Tibet and done the same thing that David Neal basically had done. And this was a fellow who, a German intellectual scholar, who called himself T, just used his first initial, Illion, Illion. And right around the time that David Neal was publishing, he came up with two books, In Secret Tibet and Darkness Over Tibet. Now, this book was first, Darkness Over Tibet, Secret Tibet, they were first published your first published, let's see, in 1937 and 1938, Darkness Over Tibet was 1938, a little after David Neal, but people were just digesting. They still didn't know. They still, even though we had David, we had Alexander David Neal a little before this, and we also had Evans Wentz material, but Ilyin was still able at that time to put these Tibetan books across and get a following and actually get people to believe them. Now, what I'm basically saying is this, that if T. Ilyin was ever in Tibet, then I've been walking around on Mars for a while, if he was ever in Tibet, because no, he wasn't. And his concept of, oh, sure, he fills his books full of little Tibetan phrases, and he's done a very, very good job of trying to give the impression that he was in Tibet. But he obviously wasn't. Or if he was, he had a very, very mendacious or a complete misunderstanding of whatever it was he was seeing. And the reason for that is this. If you read Ilyin's book from a perspective of someone who knows, now I'm going to say right now, I have not been to Tibet, neither I haven't walked on Mars either, but I have not been to Tibet. But I spent a whole year studying with, including Ken Rinpoche and the Sakya Order, and having everything directly translated in English to us. And so I do know something about Tibetan Buddhism, and I do know something about how the Tibetans approach things. And I have a number of friends who've been there and studied and whatever. And so I can tell you absolutely that Ilyin's book is not only was he not in Tibet, or if he was, he completely misunderstood what he was seeing and what he was experiencing. And the interesting, very interesting thing about this is this. If you look at his book, and you also are aware of the teachings of Rudolf Steiner, you will realize that Herr Ilyin was an ardent, fanatical Steinerite. Now, let me explain that Rudolf Steiner, theosophy in Germany split into two directions. Rudolf Steiner created something called Anthroposophy, which was Christian theosophy. It was the theosophic ideas and principles of Blavatsky, but very definitely Christian. And not only Christian, but Zoroastrian. Steiner was fascinated by Zoroaster, the dualism between darkness and light, and the eternal battle between Uhura Mazda and Ahriman. And Steiner was completely obsessed with this. Now, as Steiner, but then the other split, the other way that theosophy split in Germany, was the pagan version called Ariosophy that was the occult roots of the Nazi party. Now, the Nazis did not like Steiner at all. In fact, they burned down his headquarters, and they didn't like Steiner at all. But strangely enough, there were apparently some very ardent Steinerites who had some influence on the Nazis. And those of you who have read that book, Morning of the Magicians, you will really appreciate this, because if you wonder what this Nazi obsession with finding these secret cities in Tibet, Shambhala and Agartha, which we're going to get into in a minute. You know, I already talked about Shambhala, but now Ilyin describes in his book his sojourn in the city of the initiates, the city of darkness. This is an underground city that he was invited to go to. And it's a very nightmarish, of course, he's a good writer, and it's a nightmarish story as he goes to this city, and it's an underground city, but yet it has skylights and glass, by the way, glass skylights, which means it's a very unusual mixture here of technology, excuse me, technology and ancient architecture and whatever. But as he approaches this city, all he can see is just the low enclosures with the skylights. That's all he can detect. And then the entrances down the steps into the city, but huge underground city, but with these skylights and obviously ventilation. And the way he describes this city that he gets taken into is very detailed. And they, all the strut work in the city is done by zombies. Yep, that's right, zombies. You don't find that out until later. You wonder why they're shuffling around with their eyes rolled up in their head. That's the reason. They're zombies. And because later on he sees how they're resurrected from the dead and all this. And then he finally meets the master. And the master is very suave, and the master tries to indicate that, oh, there is no good, there is no evil, you know, we direct the thoughts of the world and all this. And but continually, Elian, everything he sees and everything he experiences, he is judging from a Steinerian point of view, light and darkness. And the thing that is so obviously untrue or non-applicable about this point of view that he has is that the Tibetans are not concerned with that at all. They're not dualistic. They light and darkness are all part of the, well, the yin and yang is a Taoist symbol, but they have no interest in light, in the conflict between light and darkness. This doesn't figure in Tibetan Buddhism at all. And I'm not saying that I'm not being a great defender of Tibetan Buddhism, because, oh, it has a what we would call a dark side to it. The dark side to it is that everything is illusion. There is no reality, and so consequently, unless you're very compassionate, which of course the Dalai Lama wants you to be, and Buddhism says you ought to be, but if you're not, you can perpetrate any kind of horrible evil you want. And there's no, you know, if as long as you have some justification for it, doesn't matter. So there can be and has been in the past a dark side, or what we would call a dark side, what you could call a bad side, an aggressive side, or whatever kind of side you want to call it. But to Tibetan Buddhism, it's not all wonderful and peaceful, but it is absolutely not this Western dualistic conflict between darkness and light. That has nothing to do with it. That is what brands Harry Elian's book as a hoax. Now the next question is, why did he go to all this trouble? He didn't profit from it particularly. Not like Lob Sang Rampa, he didn't make an industry out of it. Lob Sang Rampa was another guy who perpetrated a Tibetan hoax. Lob Sang Rampa's books have nothing whatsoever to do with Tibetan Buddhism at all. But he was an astral traveler, and he worked on his astral journeys and commercialized them and whatever. And they're interesting and, you know, in very detailed. But in the case of Elian had an agenda. Now, that agenda was not, I don't think, pro-Nazi. I don't think it was, because the Nazis, you know, didn't do very, they didn't like Steiner very much, and they were, so he wasn't trying to write something to benefit the Nazis, but I think what he was trying to do, personally, this is my personal opinion, I think it was an anti-theosophical book. Steiner, as I said, tried to put the morality back into a Christian and Zoroastrian morality back into the theosophical worldview. And Ilyin is obviously a Steiner devotee. And so I think that Ilyin's Secret Tibet and Darkness Over Tibet were both written as anti-theosophical books. And I think that's how he justified them. And I think that's what he, why he wrote them the way he did. And that's just my opinion. But I will say what's not my opinion, or at least it's my professional opinion, is that Van was never in Tibet, or if he was, he had no idea what he was looking at or what he was experiencing. But the book's interesting. If you take it for what it is, you'll find it interesting in this detailed description of this dark city. Well, now, this book was taken very seriously by Heinrich Himmler and the Unruhe and the SS. They took it very seriously, to the point where they dispatched not one but two expeditions to Tibet to try to find this city of darkness, this city of the masters that Ilyin described. So that part of it, that's one of the things that makes Darkness Over Tibet a very, very interesting book. Now, also, we might point out at the same time pretty close to the same time, colleague and our fellow anthropologist Andre Zeminski, who was on the show some time back. Remember, we had a show on Red Shambhala. That's Andre's book. He describes a Bolshevik scholar, mystic, and who managed, right when the Bolsheviks came in, before they solidified their anti-occult policies and one thing or another, when they first got started, they had all kinds of strange ideas that they were experimenting with. And so this scholar, let me put it, read a little bit of this. They sponsored the Cheka, the Russian secret police, actually sponsored this guy for a while. The next day, in his follow-up memo, Chukurin did not denounce outright the whole project, but cast strong doubt on selected routes and especially on personal charge of the expedition. It's the Bolsheviks now. For 19 years, a certain Marchenko had been searching for the remnants of some prehistoric culture, and he had a theory that in prehistoric time, humankind had developed an extremely advanced civilization that far surpassed the present historical period. He also believes that in Central Asian centers of spiritual culture, particularly in Lhasa and in some secret brotherhoods in Afghanistan, one can find surviving scientific knowledge left by this advanced prehistoric civilization. Comrade Bashenko approached Comrade Boki, who became extremely interested in his theory and decided to use the manpower and resources of his special section to locate the remnants of this prehistoric culture. Red Shambhala. And so we got the Nazis looking for it, and we have the Bolsheviks looking for it, and then, of course, we've got, oh boy, and then now we get down to the Mad Baron looking for it. And so next comes after all of this, or right about the same time as all of this, comes a white Russian, when I say white Russian, I mean an anti-communist Russian, professor and journalist by the name of Ferdinand Ossendowski. And Ferdinand Ossendowski was quite a character, and he escaped the Reds up in Siberia and went on this incredible odyssey down through the Altai Mountains and fighting off cannibals and managing to keep from freezing to death and everything else. And he finally gets down to Urga, the capital of Mongolia, Urga was kind of a mixture of the ancient, the bizarre, and the mundane, and it was kind of a tense city with some. Well, anyway, Urga was something out of the Arabian Nights in Mongolia. But Urga had been taken over by one of the most fascinating characters in modern history, Baron Roman von Ungern Sternberg, the Mad Baron. And the Mad Baron was a mystic who equated the apocalypse in the Book of Revelations with the Shambhala legend, who thought he was the reincarnation. Well, some people say he thought he was the reincarnation of Genghis Khan. Others say he thought he was the reincarnation of Tamerlane. But he had taken over Mongolia, kicked out the Chinese, and was trying to raise a Mongolian horde to attack the Bolsheviks. And he swore that he would march from Urga to Moscow and hang a Bolshevik every 100 yards. And the Mad Baron apparently believed in a strange version of the Shambhala legend, which had come from a Frenchman who had written a book back in before the turn of the century. And this book was called, and I have it right here, by the way, The Kingdom of Agartha, Journey into the Hollow Earth, by Marquis Alexandre Saint-Yves de Avedre, okay? Now, Saint-Yves had been in France back before the turn of the century, back in the fin de sec era, and he had a mysterious Sanskrit teacher who also sold canaries, but I was, and he was kind of what we would call a Bathal Swami. But anyway, he knew Sanskrit, and he was teaching St. Eve's, who was an occultist, Sanskrit. And then he got him interested in the legend of Agartha, which was this underground city, which, well, it seemed to me maybe like it was in Afghanistan. And it was called Agartha. And Eve's got so interested in it, studying with it, with this guru of his, that he took an astral journey and went to it, very detailed astral journey, and he wrote the whole thing up into a beautiful book, and it really is. It's a beautiful thing, and it's so intense, like those things, that you feel like it has some truth to it, and or it says based on some kind of a vision. Anyway, the book is published by Inner Traditions. It's got a detailed scholarly foreword by Jocelyn Godwin, who we all know, It was published in 2008, but its original was 1886 in French. Now, Ossendowski gets down to Urga, and he hooks up with Baron Sternberg. Well, Baron Sternberg, they're both white Russians, of course, they're both anti-communists, so Ossendowski gets on Sternberg's staff for a while, about a month, and he writes this book. And once he gets loose and finally escapes, Sternberg got killed off. Ossendowski wrote this book called Beasts, Men, and Gods, which he recounts all of his adventures. Now, one of the things he got it. I think he must have gotten some of it from Roman Sternberg, but he obviously got some of it from the Frenchman, St. Yves. But Askandowski recounts this whole Agartha legend almost word for word from St. Eves. And yet he swears up and down that he never read St. Eves, and we are to wonder. Askandowski's Mongolian wasn't all that good. Sternberg's was pretty good. Sternberg had been an old Mongolia hand. He'd been there for years. So I think it's reasonable to assume that the Agartha thing comes, even though Askandowski says he got it from a llama. He says he did. But I think he got it from Sternberg, who I think in turn had a copy. Sternberg was quite a mystic, and he had, you know, the Book of Revelations and the Protocols of Zion, and probably Saint Eve's Agartha all rolled into one. Now I want to say this though. Two things. Number one, Sternberg used the Shambhala legend, obviously, and he was trying to raise a Shambhala army and all of this. And very much he got the Buddhist, the blind Lama, High Lama of Mongolia, to make him the last Khan of the Mongolians, and he was going to raise the empire of Genghis Khan. He was mad. Sternberg was crazy as a loon, but he was a terrific soldier, but he was really nuts, and he probably had something to do with getting Askandowski to think that this Agartha thing was you know, the real thing. And yet, interestingly enough, the ancient campground of Genghis Khan is called Avarta. And there are some sunken ruins up there around Avarta. Now, I want to mention, before we get toward the end of the hour here, I want to mention that our friend Pastor Childress, who, bless his heart, carries Beyond Lemuria in his catalog. Anyway, he has a book called Lost Cities of China, Central Asia, and India. Okay? Now, this book is right along this theme. By the way, Childress published Ilyan's book, too. And I'm glad he did, because it fits into this whole, even though we're pretty sure Ilyan's book is a hoax, but it's still, it plays into this whole series. Now, what Childress has done here, and he's done a very good job, he's brought all these legends up to date with material that we didn't have before. Which is one of the reasons why these legends flourish so much, is because nobody could get in there into that area to do any archaeology or to really study these old texts or anything like that, because of all the wars and all the politics and all the religious prejudice and everything else going on. So this was sort of a terra incognita. So Patrick Childress has done a great job putting this together, all this in this book, Lost Cities of China, Central Asia, and India. Now, along that line, I want to mention that a couple south of Mongolia, right around in the Xinjiang area, there is another lost city that is mentioned in Churchward's book on Mu, and Childress has a chapter on it. It's one of the most fascinating of all. And that is, make sure I got the spelling right on this, that is the lost city of, what is it? Yeah, I lost it. Okay, I just want to make sure I got it right here. Let's see. Nepal. Where is it? I want to say Karakoram, but Karakoram actually was Genghis Khan's capital, and it was just a little village that he built up as a capital. So it really doesn't classify that much as a lost city. But there is one right south of Karakoram, several hundred miles south, which certainly does, and it is in the Uyghur, the old Uyghur Empire. And the old Uyghur, the Uyghurs, who you've been recently hearing about in the news, they're the Chinese have been having it out with the Uyghurs because the Uyghurs don't want to accept some of their Chinese overlords. And the Uyghurs are a very, very, very ancient race. And they are an example, unfortunately, of cultural rape. And this is one of the things about not so much the Chinese rape by the Han Chinese, cultural rape, but by the Muslims. Because the Muslims took over the Uyghurs in Central Asia, became Muslim. And when they became Muslim, they lost so much of their traditions because of this the aspect of the Muslim religion of wanting to have anything of a previous culture that seems to be or might be considered superior to official Muslim culture, they are very much against. And this is a real problem. So the Uyghur civilization. And you find this dealt with much with church word news in those Mu books, which were really not quite, you know, church word has been discredited and all that, but church word actually, there may be some things behind church word and his Mu idea that were actually might have had some proof to them. What we're finding out now, and we're finding out and here I am still looking for the name of this doggone city. I should be able to find it. Anyway, that the Uyghur civilization is really, really ancient. And so much of it's been lost and we'll probably never recover it. But what we're finding out, the archaeology that's being done and is indicating that Europeans lived in this area way back 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago. We had Caucasian, what we call Caucasian people. In fact, we had a museum exhibit at the Bowers where I sat there and looked at a beautiful, almost 6 foot tall Caucasian mummy of a Caucasian woman in a tartan skirt, and his beautiful Caucasian classic features and red hair, and she's 4,000 years old. And this is dug up right on the skirts of the Gobi Desert. And so the idea that Europeans, people from Europe, lived there at that time. And all of that history has been lost, or it's buried in records that we haven't even uncovered yet. So all of this archaeology is starting to open up now, and some of these stories that we thought were fanciful, or that we thought were completely off the wall, are turning out to have some truth to them, and. We're finding out that Siberian shamanism goes all the way through, from most ancient times, goes all the way through to the Scandinavian countries, and there is a terrific connection between Germanic and Scandinavian spirituality and shamanism and paganism, and with the traditions of Siberian shamanism. And that, of course, was the ancient religion of Genghis Khan and the Mongols before the Buddhists took over. And the Buddhists themselves in Mongolia suppressed shamanism. They suppressed it very, very ruthlessly. Shamanism, Siberian Mongolian shamanism, has had a presence that has continued and influenced religions all the way through to Western Europe. And so this whole subject of what is buried in Central Asia, what's buried in, and what documents are going to be uncovered that we haven't read yet, what new discoveries are we going to make, and are they going to actually make these legends like Shambhala and Agartha, are they going to make them seem less like legends and more like something that really existed? And I have a feeling that perhaps they are. And I have a feeling that perhaps the visions of that Frenchman St. Yves and the mad readings of Sternberg and what the Nazis were mistakenly looking for and all this, this all may have a basis, in fact. So, but I think the quest through all of this to find the truth behind it, to find the romance behind it and the truth behind it, is certainly fascinating. Now, next week, by popular request, we're going to delve into the life and the writings and the influence of Alphonse Constant, otherwise known as Eliphas Levy, and that. He had a tremendous influence on the Hermetic tradition, the modern Hermetic tradition. So, next week, Eliphas Levy, and meanwhile, good magic.